Welcome to the Muskie 360 podcast, a snowbird. How's she dangling?
Steve Areno. Yep. What is happening down there?
It's cold. It's freezing.
Oh, cold schmold.
Balmy. No, it's in the teens today.
Really?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Oh, gosh.
Not fun. Not having a blast.
You.
Not on the water today. I can tell you that much. I've been playing Office Catch-Up. That is where
And back to going to the hardware store for more WD-40, probably.
Just building baits. It's never ending.
Yeah, cool.
doing that. No, it's actually cold. We're going to snap out of it here, but man, it hit just kind of like one of those wicked little deals there. So we'll be back to the upper 40s, low 50s, I think, here shortly. But it's been good. That I'll tell you, actually, I think I don't even know if I sent you the picture. I've just been running.
You did. You got a real nice one a few days ago.
Yeah, hard.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've been on a bunch of, I kind of line it up for certain times of year with my fly fishing clients. And, ooh, that was a good, that was a nice one. That's about as much fun as you want to have on a fly rod, Jay. I'm telling you right now, there's like a certain limit of how much fun you want to have on a fly rod. That was right there. Right. That was like, hey, maybe we're in trouble, boys. That fish was troublesome on the fly. I will put it that way. But
are those fish with that cold water? What are they like behavior wise once you boat them, once you net them?
Oh,
are they
freaking,
you know what I mean? Are they a little bit kind of cold water subdued, or are they still just wild animals?
It's not that cold. You're talking upper 40s, low 50s. Sometimes it's the same deal. You know, they're still ready to rock and roll there. And I mean, you know, that's like I said, I was doing a bunch of my fly trips, and that's when you're glad you don't have treble hooks involved. You know, you can reach down there and just go, okay, gonna grab that with my hand. And you know, but yeah, they're a little bit subdued. But anyway, we're coming up on the holiday. Just got done with all that stuff. Believe it or not, not a lot of new stuff on the comings and goings here, but people went ballistic over the holidays. Hopefully, Jay, somebody stuffs your stocking with a gift card there. You know, you got that going on. People are geared up and fleared up.
Yeah, there's a lot of last-minute gift cards going out, which
get them now. What's the – just out of curiosity where I was going with that. Is the shop – when – like, if people are doing that last-minute shopping, when – I shouldn't say when is it closed, but when would you get it out the door, Jay?
Well, same day.
No, I'm saying, not you. The context of the question, or the framing of the question, would be how late should you order before you're going to get it for Christmas, unless you're doing an online gift card? Three days, 4 days from the 20th. Don't go later than the 23rd. So 19th.
So today's the 15th.
Next 4 or 5 days max.
I mean, if you ordered Friday and selected some kind of 2 day option, you should get it. You know holiday shipping.
I know.
That's what I'm saying. Everything is usually delayed. Yeah, get ahead of it. Try to order early this week, and select standard, and depending on where you are in the country, you should probably get there in time.
You know, I love it. Jody Michael open up the emails or something. But we ordered it on the 23rd, and it's not here. It's like, come on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, how about no? Get real, boss. Get real. No one cares. Don't be an idiot. If you ordered it on the 23rd, you're not going to get it on Christmas Eve. Anyway, other than that, that would be the only housekeeping there. Jay, it has been an avalanche of questions. Yeah, last week we were talking about doing a stash thing here, so we're going to have to jump right into Q&A to get through it. First and foremost, however, I forgot last week we had Glenn of the Donald on.
And, yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, good people, man. Good people.
Yeah.
And I had neglected to mention... been tinkering, right? That's what I end up doing all winter long, where I actually have a little bit more time to myself. Not much, but I got a few minutes. Did a little app Aruski update. So, update. Remember freaking the old Unsolved Mysteries? It'd be like, update. Sorry.
Vaguely.
I love that show.
Not one of those things?
No.
No, not even close.
Not even close. Stop trying. You're making
not in the same ballpark.
You're making it worse.
Terrible,
anyway,
actually.
Went in, did a little tweak-a-rooski, to the Moon app, right? So same great Moon flavor, same great Moon taste. A little bit of an aesthetic update. Make it a little bit easier, a little quicker on the boat, right? So if you go to your Moon face, same data as you always have. Underhead, overfoot, tweaking that. There'll be a little update. But you got your majors, your minors, your sun up, your moon data, everything you need. Biggest issue I'd ran into forever, and it was like the last 4 months, so it just got kooky on the code, and I finally fixed it. So I apologize, it took me a minute. But if you go to the moon phase calendar at the bottom, is a direct representation of the moon's phase visually, right? So when you look at the moon on the calendar, it's 100% right. So if I go to the 20th, okay, it's new moon, and you have a black circle. Full moon's a full moon, right?
Yeah.
Hitting it out there. So that's all right. That was just a little code tweak from the original thing. Kind of got out of sync, and this is way more visual. You'll notice that when you open your app and check that out. So that's definitely a vast improvement there. You still have the ability to look at today, previous day, go through the calendar forward and back like we did, right? Don't say I don't listen to you, because I did spend time to do this for you. And one thing I wanted to say, if you'll see it on your phone, make sure, go to the app. There's a thing on the app in the articles that talks about what you need to turn on. So it's super, you know, like dead nuts right where you're at, your location. Make sure you're allowing the permissions. We're not tracking any of your data. It's in the terms of service. We're not doing any of that fun stuff. We just need to ping you on your GPS. So it's like, boom, we know you're at this city, right? We know you're here and here. And then that allows it to calculate. When you open the app, a lot of people ask, oh, there's a window that'll pop up that says don't allow, allow. You have to hit that, because that's how I'm able to keep it free, right? Instead of like doing it without going down the rabbit hole, if you see it pop up, that's just telling you I'm bouncing off a bunch of different things called APIs, folks. Not going to go down the rabbit hole, but that keeps her free for us, and it's not tracking. Anyway, listening to your requests. There's a lot of people that aren't on the water, but they want to know what moon phase is going to be, where they're going. I added it under my 360. So it's the third tab down under the podcast. You got to ask a pro, all that fun stuff. Moon by location. You go there. You can enter in a city name, a zip code, or a lake name. It's going to pull it up for you. And then I have a list of just kind of very common lakes, whether it be, let me look here. What I got? Bemidji, Cass, Cedar Lake, Detroit River, Eagle, Georgian Bay, French River, Lac Seul, Chautauqua, Lake Erie, Huron, Nipissing, Vermilion, St. Clair, Manaquachane, all these different lakes. And, oh, there's St. Lawrence, Vilas County, all these very common places that people are going to be looking for. So you don't even have to look it up. So it's kind of alphabetical below it. That's not all that's included there. If you live in Utah, punch in your zip code, boom, you can look at it. Or say, I shouldn't even say that. If you use the regular app and you're in Utah, you're going to get it for where you're at. If you want to look at where you're going, right? Say you're planning a trip to the North Woods and you want to know what the moon phase is going to be on July 19th, 2037, you can do it now.
Right? It's like, I get it. Yeah,
I better
that's
book
great.
My
great idea.
Book my train ticket. So
planning ahead.
You drove me nuts and I did it for you. Don't forget, you got your journal. Updated the musky activity meter on there. That's just a funsy kind of basic one there. Gives you your barometric pressure and a little bit of stuff there. Nothing to live or die by, but it's there. So like I said, some updates. You still got your fun stuff. You got your journal, which a lot of people have been using and good for them. Your trolling charts, your weight calculator, hook library, all that stuff's on there. Don't forget to check that out. We got so many people doing that. And if you ever see something, hey, I want this on the app. If it's a reasonable thing, I'm willing to build it. So working on that. Let's get freaking after it. James, Merry Christmas, Stephen and Jay. My question is, I don't live by musky or pike water. What fish species is going to target to practice musky lure techniques? Pull, paws, twitch, diving rush, ripping rubber, to name a few. The wife and I have been going up to Canada for musky fishing the past couple of years, and I always feel like we're behind in techniques because we don't live near the water that have them. 2026, we're bringing our kids to Canada. Want to practice. He's saying they've got bass, walleye, striper, kind of where they're at. Here's the deal. It's never going to be the same techniques per se, but I largemouth bass fishing ain't that far off. Think about it. Rooster tails are inline spinners. You safety pin spinner baits, a lot of walk the dog. You can do your tail prop. You can do all that, right? So what I'll say is this, and not what species, what I've encouraged people to do is to actually spend time. So you're getting on the boat, like, hey, everybody, let's take our musky rods with. And what does it matter if you do 45 minutes to just get in the feel for things with no chance of catching anything? Nothing wrong with that, right? I've spent far longer than 45 minutes on the boat without catching a muskie. So maybe put 45 minutes in. It might feel stupid at first, but man, I'll tell you, when you're out of practice, those first days are tough. The closer you get to the trip, the more I'd be doing that. I'll go do it once a week. So, oh, you pick up your musky rod, it doesn't feel foreign. We're building up a rapport with the equipment. We remember what our retrieves feel like. We know what the baits feel like. We know what the baits will do. We know what the baits won't do.
Yeah,
so get out in the water and practice that stuff. You know,
Muscle memory
and just comfort. So that's what I'd be, you know, but tactic-wise, it's not going to be the same. But just, you know, take the rods out there, give them the huck and chuck. The neighbors will think, hey, they've lost their minds. That's fine. Who cares what anybody thinks? But get out there and huck and chuck them. Kevin, I owe you a huge thanks. After a few years of jamming structure up our butts, I finally have the confidence to leave the weeds and fish structure. I don't catch anything structure, but I didn't in the weeds either. Sorry. That's funny. Yeah. You fat folks, we promise we will help you find new places to get skunked. This question is about structure, sand, or mud flats. There are a lot of guys in Minnesota fishing flats and doing well. I have less than zero confidence to fish a massive flat. How do flats figure into structure? Do they? Where do I start? So, talk to him quite often, the old Bob Areno, the Dr. Bab. You know, he's a Minnesotan, and that's part and parcel for up there. That's part of what you're going to do. Now, on some of these flats, you're going to hear about, like, reed bites. You have a fall bite. There's this early fall bite in Minnesota that's like super shallow and all these different flats, and they're just crammed and jammed back there. Some of the sand flats on some of these lakes you'll target on are immense flats. Now, with that being said, Minnesota's generally windy. And the best way I've found to fish some of this stuff is just drift fish across it, right? And break it into smaller bites. So I don't care if you're talking about a Minnesota flat. That sounds like, what is it? Minnesota fats. But you've got, you know, these big sand flats, whatever you're looking at. You could be looking at a massive weed bed anywhere. This applies anywhere and everywhere. Break it down to small chunks. That's what gets people for big, vast areas, is they're like, how do I fish it? And they usually end up just blaring through it. The best way to do it is confine yourself and go, okay, I've got from that reference point on the shoreline to that reference point. I'm going to fish that effectively. I'm going to fish it thoroughly. I'm going to fish the super shallow, and then I'll fish maybe the slightly deeper stuff, and then I'll move on to another chunk. Define the shoreline, right? Now, if we're going to break a vast area up into manageable chunks, right? So we don't have spot ADUD. We don't have bait ADD. We know we're committing to this area. Bam, bam, bam. How do you differentiate where to target on a flat? That's where it gets dicier. And it varies everyone that you look at. I'm going to look at overarching structure. Is there anything, and I mean anything, that differentiates structurally leading into this flat? Is, say, the east edge of it look more complex, or it's, you know, there's something going on in the east end or the west or wherever it might be on a flat? Look in the proximity. This is when the structure matters, but also the adjacent structure plays as far as how they're going to enter in and exit an area of this nature, right? So if you have one end that kind of is, let's say you have a flat east to west, and the east side is a shallow side, but the west has the same flat, but it drops off into 40 feet of water. I'm going to bet the house on the deep edge, right? And you've got to look at it and whatever components are, and kind of go hierarchy of the two. You know, what does this area of the flat have? What does that have? And start breaking down and differentiating this for finite details, right? Maybe it might not be as obvious as that flat comes out and then it, you know, adjacent from it's the deep water. Really dig in and look for finite details. you know, looking at, you know, solar influences. I mean, what areas of a flat? I mean, if it's big enough, is there a flat on the north end and there's a flat on the south side? Water temperature, sun exposure. There's so many factors can determine why one flat would be productive or a section of a flat would be productive. So that's kind of your homework on your own that you have to do on a day-to-day or a lake-by-lake basis. But the best things you can do is break it down into small chunks and go from there. Ben, where are you looking for midsummer river flowage fish? For Wisconsin, that's it. That's the only question. When you say midsummer river flowage fish, we're thinking Wisconsin here. For reference, I primarily fish various stretches of the Wisconsin River and its flowages south of the Muskie Shop. Alternate, have either of you made your own leaders? You talk about making and tweaking baits, but don't call leaders. Okay, so let's start with leaders. Yes. Made them for quite a bit of time. I make my own sucker stuff and trolling leaders. Jay, yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm lazy and I just steal Muskie Shop leaders. But here's the thing. If you're into making your own leaders, it's the most realistically, the most economical thing you could do from a leader standpoint, right? I think a lot of people have a fear of, am I doing it right? Is it going to be strong enough? That's a question that comes up. The best place in my mind to start with making your own leaders is like AFW Toothproof. We sell at the shop. Jay, what is it, like $4 a spool? It's super cheap for the straight wire.
Yeah, it's very, less.
Highly inexpensive. So
if you want to go single strand, straight wire leader.
But that is the most simple leader to make.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to do it, I did it for years, get you a board, measure out 12 inches on the board, nail two finishing nails into it. Now you have your leader form. Bend the two ends, twist the... I've read stuff like, hey, wire twist. Wrap it around the end 3 or 4 times. It's not coming off. Clip with some clippers and you're done. That's it. Right? I actually keep a spool of that stuff in my wrecking rack on the boat in case I need to make like a glide bait or a jerk. If I see a reason... Yep. Or, hey, I get on some ridiculous, you know, walking boss or pose giant jackpot bite. Okay, maybe a straight leader would help me. I always just fished fluoros just out of convenience. But, yeah, straight wire leader's great. Jay, I know the crimping. What's the deal with the crimping tool? Like, I'm a redneck, so I've never owned a crimping tool. Do you think it matters? What's up with, like, kind of the multi-strand making them?
Yeah. Well, I used to always make my own multi-strand. I used, you know, uncoated 90-pound 7-strand wire, the flexible wire.
Mm-hmm.
You get, A3 sleeves. You get a bearing on one end, a snap on the other. Oh, yeah. When I was using that, I mean, I've recently switched, to fluorocarbon, basically. But, yeah, I mean, back in the day, I was only using those, and it's super easy to make, easier than the single-strand stuff. So, crimping wire is way better than using a needle nose because you're providing equal
tool?
Pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, a real crimping tool. It's got a selective different little half circle areas that you can apply the pressure to and, you know, prejudge what size sleeve you're using. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they've got different slots for them and use the right one. It applies equal pressure. You're not crushing the wire underneath it. And I always just take the loose end. Get about 2 inches of extra wire post sleeve, then wrap it around about 3 times real tight and then cut it. So then you got, you know, if there isn't any kind of sleeve fracture or any kind of failure, you've still got that wrapped on there. It's not going anywhere. Yeah. I never had failure doing it that way. Really easy to do.
I've told folks before and guide clients, if they want to get into that, the best thing to do, make one and then just like go outside, tie it to a tree and try to break it. You'll feel better.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's just like, okay, oh, that's the force that'll take. I mean, you got there and you're, oh, man, dude, you got a rod and drag. The fish isn't going to break it. He also said about the summer, you know, midsummer river and flowage fish. Trick on that, Wisconsin River. Yes, you can find them mid-show and deep anywhere, but a rule of thumb in that area, you've got to be thinking about where the pools are, where the deep water refuge is. Just like any structure situation, you're going to find more muskies in rivers and flowages near deep water habitat where they have a refuge. Especially when you're talking about a body of water, Jay, you get a 2-inch rainstorm come through there that just wreaks havoc. You know, you need a deep water refuge. Muskies and rivers, they might not be in it all day long, but they're near it. They can get there
darn
quick.
Right. Yeah, right? Adjacent river channels, yep, right, and all that.
Start with deep water. And it doesn't mean in a river, it's not odd, but it's just a slightly different animal than a main lake basin. But in a river, we might have a deep hole, right? Maybe it's a 200-yard deep, the deeper section of the river and whatever. We're in plover, whatever. Find the deep water, and then we're going to work adjacent. It might be a half mile, and they're all upshalling here. There's a reason or a hierarchy to why that shallow section is productive and others aren't, because it's proximity to deep water. Muskies always want a deep water refuge, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm going to look
for. Deep's relative, too. Right. It could be 14 feet.
Right.
At you max. Know, not yeah. even the length of your boat.
Right. You know, you sink her, she's standing on in. I can still see the nav lights, they said. But, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, like I said, most of the time you're going to find them in the proximity of those deeper water sections. It'll branch out from there. The more stable it is in a river system, the more they branch out. Right? So you can kind of play it from there and dial in. Keep rocking, Frank. I'm old and I can't work technology, so I can't find the minutes, but haven't missed an episode in 3 years. Like most, after listening to your podcast, I caught some more muskies and suck a little less. Got any tips for rod control and a boat side strike? Do you keep moving with the tension or keep the rod deep? Well, Frank, thanks for listening. Coming in the figure eight, we hook a fish, right? I'm going with him. It's a quick happening. It's boogie woogieing right there at your feet. All hell has broken loose, right? He grabs it. I'm not going to try to force him in any direction at the very beginning. I'm talking fish is on, right? I'm walking the dog. I don't mean working a jackpot or a walking boss. I mean, I'm just taking the dog for the walk. Where does he want to go? I'm going to keep tension in front of him, but I'm kind of following his lead, right? Meaning I don't want the fish past me. I want to lead him where I want to lead him, but he's going to kind of let you know that at first kind of few seconds where he wants to go. Right. I've had them try to rock it down. So I'm jamming the rod. I've had them go sideways. I've had them every which way but loose. They've tried to go every direction. You're going to know quickly which way he's going. Keep that rod in front of you. Don't want the rod behind the fish, if that makes any sense. You never want the, you know, you don't want to be parallel to him. You want those hooks leading that fish. It's often chaotic, but, you know, that first few seconds, he's going where he wants to go. And whether you know it or not, you become in control after that. So that initial grab, go where he's going after that, take control. That makes sense, Jay? Am I articulating that appropriately? That resonate? That clicking?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? So you're dancing. We're dancing partners here. We're about to tango. The fish is in the lead at first because you want to make sure the hooks are in. You want to make sure that he's not going to get the head shakes out and just tear him out right then. We're leading him based on where he's going, and then we kind of take over. So if that fish wants to go to the right, I'm going to start leading him to the right. All right. And then I'm going to start turning him back around. Right. So at the initial surge, go with him. After that, you take over who's leading that dance, and it'll put you more muskies in the net.
Agreed.
Hello, Steve and Jay. I might not have 18,000 minutes like the guys talk about the podcast, but I'm up there. LOL. You guys are very insightful and have gotten a lot of information from you both. Look forward to hearing the show every Monday. Love the podcast. Sometimes in the summer, it's more Sunday. If you notice, winter, we get a little more Monday. But, oh my goodness, 12,000 minutes plus. That is stellar, my dude. Much appreciated. Yeah. Going here. Steve, I think I might have a problem. Oh, God. My question is, how much money do I have to spend at the muskie shop to get a response on the podcast? Zero. You don't have to spend any. So you're getting a response now. So loves the book. Loves your book. Loves the show. Can't fish. Can't fish, but still see you guys at the bash this summer. Can't wait to keep it up. Psychotic fan, Michael. 22,645 minutes, Jay.
Wow.
That is days. Listen, appreciate it. If you're coming to the bash, send me a message, remind me. I will bring you something I made in my garage that's not a bait that sucks. How does that sound? Appreciate it. All right. Well, we got Corey. Love listening, guys. Lots of great advice. Last, fortunately, in this situation, my problem for not being able to retain information has allowed me to listen to the episodes multiple times. 21,410. These are screenshots, Jack. 21,410 minutes. Wow. You too. That's back-to-backers. Good on you guys. Much appreciated. You know what? Both of you, you know, screw it. Both of you, Michael, send me your address. Corey, send me an address. I'll put you something in the mail. Jay, I'm looking here in the Bay Cave. I actually just finished up. I got a tiny little batch of some stuff I made. I might have some wooden Titans. So, guys, send me your email. I'll send you a Titan I made out here. Oh, God, grief, Jay. That's a lot of time. So, what we got here.
Yeah, it is.
That's a lot of good. I love it.
Well, you mentioned some guys are, you know, they're repeated listening. They're like, I don't retain things I listen to. You move quick, Steve, you know, and sometimes that's why we don't do it live, right?
What we are doing it live, baby.
You hit rewind. Well, we are, but no one's listening right now yet.
Ever. No one's listening ever. I made all those emails up to make me feel better about myself. No one listens to this. Jay's not even real. This is all just the Matrix. It's just a sad and weird. Wake up, Neo. It's time to eat your slop.
Muskie 360 AI.
Sam! Steve Stash. I fish mainly flowages this summer. I've been wondering how to find the moving water and break lines on these lakes. Love the podcast. Jay, how do you find the moving water sections and break lines in a flowage?
Well, you go out there on a non-windy day, so yeah. You can pick up, you know, one thing is if you're familiar with the water, if you fish it a lot, you know, look at how the weeds are laying, mm-hmm. and how bad they're laying. You know, a lot of flowages and rivers in Wisconsin right now have that dreaded stringy weed type stuff, which is really easy to read. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. that stuff is very flexible and it's very fine. So if there's strong current, you'll be able to see it, you know. And sometimes that changes too. You know, the wind, it plays impact on current and all that too. So I don't fish fast moving water at all. So if you're on a normal river, it should be relatively easy to see.
Do you know how I find this stuff, Jay? I do it the same way I find friends. I look for trash. Okay. Just look for trash, folks. No, it's to be honest with you, a trick that you can look for, Jay said, like the vegetation. I'm looking for flotilla, like garbage on the water. You'll see it in flowages where you'll find where water's moving and not look. If you're trying to find where current seams are or where water's actually moving versus water's not moving, right? And it's not a visual cue of like heavy current. Look at those pockets. Where are you seeing kind of garbage lines or broken weed? Anything. You'll see just floating crap in one area, and there's a definitive edge to it. Right? Now, not every time do you get that opportunity, but on occasion, take mental notes. Just don't drive by something and go, oh, that's a bunch of garbage. Right? Sometimes it's just a bunch of garbage. But you go, what's going on over there? Why is there this kind of this junk over there or whatever it might be? Again, broken weeds, whatnot. I've seen crazy people, Jay, myself included in this camp, who have taken muskie bobbers, you know, your big 3-inch bobbers, just throw them out in the lake and see where they end up. If it's not windy, they'll go with the current eventually.
That's true.
And you can find, I mean, how much time do you have, right? But it will find its way, or you can just watch them. You got to be observant. Another great way to find these things, and again, this is, you have to have the right conditions for it, but days that it's foggy on the water. Because if you think about current, right, most of the time you're going to have a temperature differential. You'll have slack water and you have the moving water. You can actually see on foggy days, on flowages, rivers, the whole bit, you'll go, oh, the fog's not right over there. It's slightly warmer. It doesn't take a lot to change whether fog is produced or not. And if you pay attention to that, you'll notice pocket pools and eddies. You might even play pocket pool, Jay. Who knows? Out in the fog, nobody can see it. But nonetheless, out in the fog, you can see pocket pools and eddies, right? Mm-hmm. Who's going to stop you? But you're in a boat. It's the woods. But you'll notice these areas and go, huh, there's no fog there. Or that differentiates. In fog density, it differentiates. That's when you know where current seams are, or you know where the slack water areas are. One of my favorite ways to find them, again, foggy mornings, my head's on a swivel. I'm looking for everything. I'm going, whoa, there's something there. Whoa, that's different. Whoa, that's different. Right? And it becomes, whether you're doing it in your notes on the app, you're doing it on your graph, whatever. I mean, your brain needs to quickly become a repository for any of these areas you're seeing. And I've gone out before where I go, oh, it's foggy. And I go, all right, if it's safe, I'm going to cover as much water as I can in the boat to learn as much as I can quickly. What's happening here, right? You'll notice a lot of different things are kind of splayed out there in front of you. Another one I'm just riffing on a lot, pollen in the spring or in the fall. Pollen can kind of be an indicator too. It's another flotilla.
But yeah, big time. That's true.
Yeah. And it's just, oh, open your mind and open your eyes. You'll see it out there. Paul from PA. Hey, guys, love the podcast. Always makes me laugh. My question for a chance at Steve's stash. Some of these answers are getting a little bit more game showy, and I like that. I like it. My question for a chance at Steve's stash. In the fall, the trend is to go bigger in size with your lures. Having no choices for muskies and PAs to let me torture myself year-round. Fishing off the bank of a local river through January and February, would you recommend spending more time throwing the big stuff or scale back in size? More spring-ish. I mean, that's a tough call. That's a day-to-day call, really. Something that I've noticed, and I got a big enough sample size that I'm confident in it, but I'm not going to, like, put it down in stone and etch it in to tablets and say this is right. I believe over the course of winter, for you guys that do have open water and open seasons, it's kind of cyclical week within week. There's a cycle that kind of turns over throughout the month, right? You know, and is it new moon in your area? Is it full moon? What is it? What's the trigger? But there's like, okay, this is the week and a half big stuff is working, then you better back it down. Because there's what I perceive, and again, I'm not writing it down yet. I'm not etching it into tablets for Jay to walk up Mount Minocqua yet. But my thought is there's a feeding cycle throughout the winter where there's one week or one period where they're eating big, they're looking for calories, and the rest is maintenance. You know, don't kill me. Might not work on your water, but it kind of works with a lot of the experience that I've had. And so what I've always done is try to make sure throughout the course of the day, over winter months, I'm giving them the buffet. You might catch a fish yesterday on a 10-inch bait, and the next day you may have to turn around and go down to a freaking bass-sized crankbait. With no change in weather, nothing. There's just some kind of something happening. Like I said, my sample size, my data says it, right? That I need to be exploratory in bait sizes from both extremes over the course of the winter. Now, forage type could influence that, but I feel like there's that really good week, and then they back her down a little bit, and they're picking off mid-sized stuff, and then we go back into it, and then we're in kind of spawning temps and everything neutralizes. But that's kind of my thought. I would be throwing both. I know that's a catch-all answer, but when you'll notice it, hopefully, or maybe not, who knows, you might notice a system of when the bigger stuff is working for you based on what's taking place there. So play with that and go from there. Goodness, cover them, Jay. Keep going. Keep grinding. There's plenty. Scott. Hello, Steve and Jay. What's the best color of braid to use? Also, I'm going to give trolling a shot next season. Any advice on getting started? I don't think it matters, Jay. What do you think?
color of line, I don't think it really matters. I mean, when the braided line came out, you didn't have many choices, and a lot of it was either salt and pepper, which is white with like little pepper flecks in it, or it was white. I remember Tough Line Plus came out. It was like white or gray. Anyway, it was light colored. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I caught a million muskies using that line, which is the opposite of where everyone's thinking and where the industry's gone now. It's just like, it's got to be more camouflage, you know, moss green, a dark green color is by far the most popular.
Right.
But, I think they all work. I don't think it matters too much.
When I was doing Next Level Braid, which a lot of guys use now and all that stuff, I mean, I thought about it. And what was cool is that the company that actually produces the fibers, that Japanese company, they sent me multiple grades of what we were working on, right? So I'd talk to them over the phone and Zoom and all this stuff, and we kind of tweak what we were doing. And then I'd get a sample. But every time they sent a sample, Joe, it's rainbow colored. I have spools of it. Like, I have a couple tranks that still have it on there that are up on the
rainbow
shelf.
Rainbow colored? What was that like?
It looks like rainbow sherbet. It looks like metered line, but it's in like 2 feet increments. Just all the different. It doesn't matter. I fished it just to be a jerk. People would ask all the time, what's up with that line? And it's just a sample. But I was testing the different braids, the way we composed that line. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it didn't matter at all. And there was one point back in the day I was fishing Suffolk. I remember they had a sale on saltwater. It was 80-pound saltwater braid, but it was like hot pink. I bought it just to prove a point. If line color is the differentiating factor between getting bit or not, you're in deep, deep doo-doo. Right? Things are bad, man. That's about as tough as she can get. So, you know, I've not used a black braid that I recall. Right now I fish obviously my braid with the Next Level, which is just green because that's what everybody wants, but I'm not afraid of any other color. Think about it, Jay. How much trolling did we do back in the day? I mean, I know I did with freaking like 30-pound trilene, like that glowing neon green color trilene. That's, you know, that's kind of what you were. Heck, I mean, everybody was trolling with 30-pound monofilament for a minute, you know, and just hot color, you know.
Yeah, when I started, you either had to use monofilament or Dacron. And I just like that Dacron was such high diameter. Mm-hmm. You had to have a 6,500 spool just to get. I mean, if you were using 36-pound Musky Master, remember that stuff?
Oh, yeah, it's horrible.
That was Dacron. It cuts so. I mean, I guess the advantage to it back then was that it was fairly low stretch. That so was it. Hook setting was improved, but that's about it. It was, you know, Dacron quickly went away. It's good for backing now. That's about it. You know? Cortland Master Braid is awesome, but you know that's a super line. It has nothing to do with Dacron.
No.
And mono, and it's like you had to find. I was experimenting with different monos. Like they had that. It's like I wanted to get a little bit lower diameter, but still have. Remember that? God, what was it? Stren made some line. It was like 1630 or something like that. It was like oval.
Wire?
No, it was a clear mono.
Before your time. Yeah. No, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I was trying all different stuff, you know, and just like, oh, that mono was awful.
I mean, you want to talk about learning to set the hook. You better set the hook, and you better probably set her three times. I mean,
a lot of stretching that stuff, baby.
I'll tell you, I just have nightmares about missing fish. I mean, me and Herbie were commiserating one time about that. Just like, oh, God, you think you got them and you're not. You just don't have it. There's no way. I mean, my grandfather and dad used to do it all the time. Like, all right, get 30 feet away with hold a lure in your hand. Get 30 feet away and set the hook and see what happens. You can't even rip it out of your buddy's hand. And I'll play that. I'll play that game. Take a bait. I don't recommend this, but I've done it a bunch of times. Take, say, like a crane bait or whatever. Have 30-pound mono on with your musky rod and see if you can pull it out of somebody's hand. You can't. You can't. And so that was the nightmare. Thank goodness for Super Braid. I'll tell you, mono, the best thing mono ever did was teach you how to monitor your hooks and keep them sharp, because you basically need the sucker to hook himself. Sean, hey guys, love the podcast. Look forward to hearing the next one, no matter what the time of year is. I'm from Michigan. We have a year-round season. Question is, what kind of depth and structure and lures would you be looking for as soon as the ice starts melting off and we get back to open water? Interesting. That's the coincidental of, I was working on a little project here I'm working on, Jay, and that kind of subject is something I was talking about today or working on. About, you don't hear a lot about pre-spawn, right? Just that statement makes people's cackles stand on end where you have a close season. Whoa! Right?
Mm-hmm.
You can hit them. I know guys doing the UP. There's different fisheries due to in PA, all this stuff. And I mean, it becomes obvious when muskies go into spawn mode, they just disappear. But there's definitely a pre-spawn feed up.
Oh, yeah.
And when the ice comes off in some of these areas, it's interesting because you can pick up right where you were. You might come off a 12-inch, like the last trip of the year, you're out there trolling 13-inch grandmas, right? Ice comes on, ice comes off, it's time to do the same. Don't be afraid when that ice comes off to go big. They haven't spawned yet. They're still looking for high caloric meals. Now, depending on the fishery, depending on the size class, some of them might be more in caloric maintenance, right? They might be all the way already at max. They've got all their food and fuel, and they're just kind of eating moderate stuff. But I've been on bodies of water where it's like, okay, wow, first cast of the year, and we're throwing pounders because they're just big forage based. That's just a fishery that is all about big forage. You know, bam, you're right in it. So it's interesting to think about from that perspective. Right when that water comes off, it's cold. You know, let's say you got water in the 30s, 40s, whatever. You need big profile baits, big flat-sided crank baits, dive and rise. Your Suix and your Titans are deadly right then and there. You know, and where I would start at, I would go pretty reasonably big for whatever the forage base is, the lake you're fishing. I would go reasonably big, and I would rotate between going from big to small to extra big. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, start at 12 inch baits. Maybe we're going down to 8 to 10. Maybe we need to try bigger than that to trigger strikes. But it's an interesting opportunity you have when you have those open seasons and open water there. Oh, keep on rocking. We're trying here. I'm speed reading. Right? Hold on. Let me skip that one there. That's more. That was 4 pages. John, Steve Stash. While fishing in a canoe without electronics, is it possible to fish deeper water? If so, do you have tips to fish without electronics? Love the podcast. Jay, what do you got? You've done more canoe. He's fishing out of a canoe, no electronics.
No, I don't fish out of a canoe.
Right. I'm saying you have. I thought you did more John back in the day.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, I guess. Can you fish deeper water in a boat, a small boat without electronics? Of course. It would be a lot easier on a river than it would be on a lake to know exactly where you're at. Unless it's clear water, it's early season maybe, and the water's still super clear and you can actually physically see the weed lines. But if it was a lake in that situation, it would be relatively easy just to fish the weed lines and fish that break. You could probably keep on the break visually on a non-windy day. But, yeah, rivers, absolutely. You know, then you got a perfect trolling speed going, too, you know.
Yeah,
that's so you'll spend more casting. Okay. That's the thing with a small boat that is very hard to control, is that drift might be just absolutely perfect just due to natural current in that situation, fishing the deeper breaks.
Yeah, I haven't been in a canoe in so freaking long. I've been in John boats, but I'm trying to
canoes
think.
Canoes are really tough. They're just so tippy.
I mean,
tough.
It's because he says you can fish deep water, but I think a lot of it's going to be canoe control, if you will. To be able to get out there and be a stable and effective, like you're saying. I mean, if there's deep water, say he's on a lake, right? Did he say it? Let me check. He doesn't say. Doesn't matter. So say you're on a lake you know, your best option, like Jay said, it might be, hey, I don't have electronics. Let's go 30 feet back with a depth rater and canoe that edge and learn the edge by watching your rod for ticking and clicking. Right. So you're going to learn where your levels are, or heck, all these different phones on your app have some kind of mapping to at least go off of and do the research with crankbaits and be probative and figure out the basic structure where the deep water is, you know, from a standpoint of being able to, you know, because I'm trying to think, dude, you get in, say, in the middle of like one of these Northwoods lakes or whatever, there's even a little bit of wind or whatever. I can't imagine standing or sitting in a canoe and trying to cast, say, like a deep crankbait or big rubber. I'm sure there's people that can do it, but it's going to be pretty problematic.
Exactly what, right? I was thinking. Yeah just it's, due to the motion and the physicality, right, of it. It'll be dangerous, right, standing in a canoe. You don't want to put yourself in a situation.
I'd troll, like you're saying. I would rig up and troll over deeper stuff, cast your edges and do all that. But I mean, you know, I think there would be an opportunity to do that. I mean, you look at some of the old row trollers, they're out there basically laying down and smacking big fish.
Yeah,
you know, right. More. Dude, it's been a long time since I haven't crawled in the canoe in a long time. John boats are enough of a headache for me. I am not, you know. You get used to luxury, Jay. You know, I'm sitting here going, I was jealous. One of my bass friends has heated seats in his boat now. Now I'm jealous. I need heated seats in my boat. I you know. Whew, it's tough. But yeah, get out there and give her a troll. Michael, forgive me for what might be a dumb question. There's no way. He says, quasi-related to Steve Stash. I live in Wisconsin and don't have a heated garage. I take my rods and reels indoor for the winter, but should I do the same with baits and leaders? Okay. He streamed 10,277 minutes at the pod this year. That is ridiculous. Thank you very much. He said, help catch his biggest fish and highest number of fish with his limited time on the water. That's freaking awesome. Much appreciated. Awesome. Should he take his baits in and leaders? I don't know if leaders would be affected. I would take my baits in somewhere that was warm. I've been in a Wisconsin garage in winter before, Jay. I know you have. Not fun, right?
Yeah, something a little bit more climate controlled might be better for them. The hooks and the split rings can tarnish. You know what I mean? They can deteriorate if there's a fluctuation in humidity and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I got a pretty damp basement, as you know, Steve. I had some baits down there years ago.
I didn't like how you said the humidifiers,
and it's like. That.
Got a pretty damp basement. You should know.
That's where I put Steve down there. Yeah, but no, that's probably be a smart thing, is not keep him in there. Put him in the house. Keep him dry.
Of all things, this week I was helping on the Livingston front here, as I always do, from a design perspective, and we're talking about some of their bass stuff, and they're working on a project for a bass lure, and I was kind of pulled in to advise on a little subject. Right, looking at it. And long story short, from a manufacturing standpoint, we're running into a heat issue. And I looked at the absolute, and I'm talking the foundational properties of ABS, right? You'll see these guys that get any ABS bait, and they'll leave it out in bright sun, or they'll leave it in their car, or they'll leave it somewhere, and it deforms. I've seen it with a lot of Jakes and all this stuff. It depends on what bait it is, meaning how they've mixed their ABS and the grade of ABS and all this stuff. But generally, I mean, you're at 155 to 175 degrees, you can expect deformation. Which, if you go, oh my goodness, if you take a ABS bait and leave it on the dashboard of your truck in August, guess what? Kiss it goodbye, right?
Yeah, it's done.
So you have a high heat tolerance. Also, what I'm getting at is there's not a low tolerance, but there is, and I'm talking on a very, very, very small level, there's constriction of that material, right? So extreme cold, that actually constricts slightly, and I'm talking, dude, I'm reading the freaking 53-page freaking thing published by the people that make the raw material for this, right? This is not exciting stuff, but I'm looking for info where you can actually damage things by it being too cold. Now, in general, what we're using them for, that's not going to be there, but that is, it's worth noting that it there's fluctuation there. Just like wood can fluctuate, ABS plastics can fluctuate, especially because the more air that's trapped into it, the air, blah, 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 you figure it out in your head. So it kind of made me at least consider, Jay, I might be a little bit kinder to some of my plastic baits this winter, right? Because I notoriously will have all my trolling baits, or I'll leave stuff laying on the deck. So what? They got froze to the deck of the boat. They'll thaw out tomorrow, right? Just to consider that it could cause some damage and possible a failure. So I would definitely have my lures inside the house, stick them under the bed so the wife doesn't kill you. You know what I'm saying? And leave them dry. But I don't think any of us are going to fish, like, you know, take a headlock to Antarctica tomorrow or anything. But just worth considering that all those materials do have a little bit of give and take there. What we got? What you got? Where are the drugs? Batman. Shane. Why no possum hunt? That's all he says. Oh, actually says, why no mo possum hunt? Jay, why no mo possum hunt?
Well, you haven't had a good old-fashioned possum hunt in years.
Because of people like you, Shane. That's why. Always ruining the possum hunt with your emails about why there are no mo possum hunts. Maybe I like that Jay put it on the ledger of things we'll make promises to do. I always enjoy the website Easter egg hunt.
Yeah,
that's fun. If you don't know, folks, we'll put something, we'll come up with something absolutely ridiculous you got to find on the website. It'll be like 19th picture back for gulp power bait or something ridiculous. And it'll be like, you know, Jay killing that guy in Medford. Here's Tony. What would you suggest if I had several follows on a particular swim bait but no takers? The same thing I'd recommend if you got several followers and no takers on any other bait. You need to start considering, first and foremost, what am I doing with the bait? Am I adding any triggering properties in? Is there something I can do with this retrieve, right? Before I change baits, is there something I could be doing? Am I just throwing it out and turning the handle and going, oh, they're not hitting it? Do my figure eight suck, right? Think about those things. I'm going to address and realistically look at what I'm doing on the retrieve. And if I feel comfortable and competent, like, okay, I've been doing enough. I have been adding some mid-cast triggers. I have been paying attention to my running depth. I am doing competent wide, you know, speed and depth change figure eights. Everything looks kosher. Then I'm going to consider a change. Maybe I go bigger. Maybe I go smaller. But I want to address those things first and foremost, because I think it's easier to say, they're not hitting us bait. Well, they'd hit it if you did it right. That's just my guide brain. I shouldn't say it that way, but I've stood on the boat too many days. I'm like, oh, that's the third one that didn't eat it. They'd eat it if you did it right. And you've got to be introspective enough to go, what can I do before I blame the bait? Right? What can I do? What is this bait capable of that I'm not taking advantage of? Or whatever factor. Address your stuff, then consider, maybe I upsize, downsize. And immediately, I mean, for me, I go, well, I know I'm doing it right most of the time, so it's time to generally downsize.
It's information.
It's information.
And yeah, you got to read it. Yeah, exactly.
You know, just take it for what
you want. I mean, if they're interested at some level, if they're following.
Right. So. I'll tell you, I hate switching baits. I really do. Mm-hmm. Once I'm dialed in, I am the king of, and it's not, let me put it this way. If I know what they're on, I'm waiting for if there's a hierarchy and you got to go through, let me step back and say this. I feel competent and comfortable with certain baits in certain patterns, and I know that it will get eaten. Therefore, I'm reluctant to make a change or downright refuse, because it'll 90% of the time I'm going to get it to pay off, right? So don't take that in what I was just saying. I hate change of baits. It's like, if I'm dialed in, I don't want somebody to go, I'm leaving my bucktail on all year long. That's it. Never taking it off. I just hate making a change when I've been dialed in, you know, and it's not a matter of I'm trying to prove my point or win the argument with the fish. I just go, you know, I hate readdressing. That's why I'm so big on all these freaking baits I'm making. If you noticed, modular weighting for a reason, right? Okay. Magnus has been really good to me this year. It's been whomping these cold water fish. All right, what do I need to do? Do I need to just go deeper? You know, all these different factors. And I think it's easy for us to take a bait, throw it out there, and they go, they're not eating it. And then just start going through the tackle box, and then we're going through the tackle box, and then we stop seeing fish. So like I guess I'm just kind of doubling back on what I said. Consider and be proactive and introspective about what you're doing for real. Right? Don't just, I'm the best figurator there ever was. There's no way I'm doing it shitty. Hey, are you? I'm not. Maybe you are, but I try to consider that stuff. If you do have fish coming up, and I'm not beating up my mic to ask a question, obviously there's a time to downsize. Obviously there's a time to upsize. But I want to try to capitalize on that bait that's moving fish is where I'm getting at with this thing, Jay.
Right.
I've been trying to get that out of my mouth for a minute here for some reason. I just can't get it. But
yeah,
I mean, that's kind of where my brain's at. Like, it's moving them. They like this, right? What am I doing wrong? Don't blame the bait. Go, what can I do with this bait to trigger that strike? Because sometimes you downsize and go, they magically stop moving. Sometimes you upsize. No, there's nothing. You put back on what they're moving on. You go, oh, crap. You know? There they were. Right there. The end of your rod. Anyway, Jay.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking for next week? Okay. I already told the two guys. The two guys, I already said it earlier. Shoot me the email. I'll hook you up there.
Yeah,
I say
cool.
Send in your questions for next week. We'll grind through it because it's holiday week, right? Get them out there. We'll do another Steve Stash. Maybe a nice, I know what we'll do. We're going to do a nice, just an old-fashioned, Jay, old-fashioned post-Christmas possum hunt after the
fact.
We could
do a possum hunt. We could have a holiday special coming up, too.
You know, who knows what we got. There might be things up sleeves. There might be things up other things. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Oh, yeah.
You never know what's hiding around sleeves. And
you never know what's coming.
All right, wizard sleeve. Anyway, goodness, Jaber, we'll get on it. Guys, send your questions. We'll do another Steve Stash this week. Heck, you know what? Because we did the podcast, I kind of... freaking hold on, just do another one, just email it. What do you got, Jay? Tell me when. I'm going to do a question because we had the other guys, because we kind of said send in your things and your questions, so I kind of double fed the beast, so it's not fair to the people just send how much they listened. My eyes are shut, Jay. I'm rolling the mouse back and forth on this list of emails. Tell me when.
Okay, ready?
Yep.
And now,
Kevin. It's Kevin. Your email address is at Hotmail. So first, you just want a new email address from not Hotmail. That's what you actually need because you have a Hotmail account still somehow. You went back in time and still have Hotmail. Anyway, I'm teasing. I'm teasing. But Kevin, I see your email starts with a K and it's at Hotmail. Send us a message. I'll send you out something from Steve Stash, you other guys with those insane listening hours I said earlier, Corey and Michael. Send it. I'm going to send you guys something bad to the bone there, but awesome. Jay, say good afternoon.
Thanks, guys. Take care.